Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
This podcast is brought to you by Innate. We hear it from our podcast guests frequently. Today's capital projects require the highest degree of visibility. That's why we at the Project Chatter podcast want to tell you about construction project management software from Innate.
It's software that integrates every aspect of your project and puts you in control. Innate's cloud-based solutions provide a connected data flow that improves efficiency and guides better outcomes across the entire project lifecycle.
See what Innate software can do for your next construction project. Learn more at innate.com. That's INEIGHT.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Plan Academy. Plan Academy is the world's leading learning site for anyone working in construction project management or project controls.
At Plan Academy, you learn construction planning and scheduling theory, how to master scheduling software like Primavera P6, and even advanced construction scheduling techniques.
Plan Academy's courses are 100% online and at your own pace. You can learn at the office, at site, from home, anywhere. Get $75 off any Plan Academy course by visiting planacademy.com/chatter. That's planacademy.com/chatter.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by justdo.com. Justdo is a great business and project management tool we've been using here at Project Chatter.
I agree, Val. I like to keep things simple and Justdo is perfect for that. But I do know it's got a lot of powerful functionality as well. And one of my favorites is the task-specific chat.
Absolutely. And for all you slackers, don't wait for Monday. Check out justdo.com. Now on with the pod.
Hello, project people. You're listening to the one and only Project Chatter podcast, your trusted source of project experts. I am your host, Mr. Val. I can't even pronounce my name anymore. Mr. Val Matthews. It is Friday here in Australia. And I am joined by my co-host, Dale Fung.
I thought you were going to say Dr. or Sir Val Matthews or something
Mr.
like that.
Or Puck. Yeah, I could have said anything, but I didn't. I left it open.
No, it's awesome. It's awesome. Hello, listeners. It's amazing. Another episode. And this, I think, is going to be quite intriguing for the masses, this topic. So I'm keen to peel back the layers on this one, Val.
Oh, there was another onion joke in there somewhere. I'm with you, Dale. But just a reminder to our listeners to hit that subscribe button on whichever platform you listen to your good podcast on. And don't forget our YouTube channel where you can see our faces and subscribe. And if you'd like to sponsor the podcast, you can get in touch with us, projectchatterpodcast.com. Check us out, send us a note or a message. In this pod, we are humbled and joined by Mr. Michael Tuchatti to talk about capability partnering and why education, learning, and applying matters to projects. Hey, Michael, welcome to the show, mate. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thank you very much, Val and Dale. Pleasure to be on here. Thank you.
No, as usual, it's always our pleasure. And look, we don't have a direct bio from you, so I'll hand over to Dale to ask you some probing questions about your history first.
I don't know how probing I might be, because I heard before we hit record, Michael, that you've been at Blue Visions for 20 years. Now, that is, I think, that sort of loyalty is unheard of. So Blue Visions is doing something right, or you doing something right, or both, but you're obviously onto something good. So I want to hear all about those 20 years, and even if there's a bit of a story before the 20 exactly. years as to what your origin story is and how you came to being where you are today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. So I still look very young, I hope. And the only
absolutely.
Thing that's happened to me is I've widened a little bit, I guess, in that time. So, but no, I have an interesting history. I started studying telecom engineering and it was back in the late 90s. And my neighbor actually came across and said, would you like to get a job? And I said, doing what? And he goes, working as part of a project management office or a PMO on a $3 billion 3G rollout across Australia. And, you know, this is at the time when all my friends are working at supermarkets and fast food chains. And here I'm an opportunity to work on a sort of a $3 billion program across Australia on cutting edge technology. So, so absolutely took up the offer and, you know, started to develop a real interest in project management, started to learn about large scale projects and programs. And I was fortunate from the perspective of being an administrator, but providing like project admin, I was in a lot of executive meetings. So I was hearing firsthand how sort of the managing director of 3 Mobile was about network rollouts and IT systems and, you know, the construction, hiring, sales teams, et cetera. And so through that, really got a real passion for project management and project controls. Progressed on there to running a lot of projects, IT related, some capital works projects. And it got to a point where our clients actually started saying to us, you know, Blue Visions, you're running projects really well, but when you finish, our organization is no better to run the next project without you. We need to keep calling you back. So can you help us build capability so that, you know, we can still call you back, but not as much? And so we started to run a lot of sort of project management training programs by real project managers, individuals that, you know, sort of Monday to Thursday would be running a project and on Friday would do a keynote speak or a course for a client. And a lot of the conversation at that point was, wow, that's really real. You know, you're sharing not just an academic view, but a quite a real view of project management. And we could see the impact that was having to these organizations. And I guess the rest is history for me. You know, I really took a passion to seeing those organizations change, the people within them change, and the benefit they took from it. And yeah, sort of what's kept me here for 20 years? I guess it's, even though it's within the one company, I've sort of worked across about 150 odd organizations. And so you get to know a lot of different organizations and the people within them. And I think that variety for me has really been what's kept it fresh and what's kept it, you know, sort of something that I've enjoyed doing for 20 years. So
that is awesome. Variety, I think, is something that we as humans relish, and we really, we really react positively when we are, when we're given that variety. So I appreciate what you're saying there, but it's quite interesting as well. I was just listening in. That neighbor of yours, did you ever thank him for all of the blood, sweat and tears, or her, you know, that they put you through the years?
Absolutely. The owner of the business was cursing him for about 20 years, and but I was thanking him for about 20 years. So yeah, absolutely. It was a real shift in my career. I actually never did engineering as a result of that. I always moved down a project base. Yeah, it's interesting.
It is very interesting. It's just those fine margins of how things change. But thank you for sharing your story. So capability, partnering, and why education, learning, and applying matter. So let's break that up. Capability, partnering. You touched on it briefly, working with your clients, building their capability. But what more is it to it? What are the frameworks involved? How do you get, is it trying to source a new pipeline of individuals versus, or is it just upskilling their current staff, bit of both? Tell us more about it.
Yeah, really good question. A story that's really fun to me is a very large international fast-moving consumer chain. They do infant formulas within Australia. We knew their managing director. She called us in and she said, we've got a really talented group of people. They're really committed. They work really hard. But I find they're always fighting fires. And the word project is a dirty word for them. If they're nominated to be a part of a project, they know they're going to be part of something that doesn't actually achieve or doesn't succeed or has a lot of problems. And so for this particular client and this particular organization, she said, how can you build capability whilst preserving the soul of the company? For us in that regard, what did that involve? A lot of focus on, first of all, getting in there and seeing how are they currently running their projects? What are they currently doing? And putting a little bit of structure from an organizational perspective into how they plan and engage different parts of their organization. And they were quite cynical at the beginning. So we said, okay, well, let's test this theory of planning out. And they had a new initiative. We pulled in quite a cross-section of stakeholders that would normally not be involved. It's normally like marketing involved at the outset, operations at the end. And we pulled them in and identified a number of things in that meeting that resulted in that project stopping. And the termination of that project was a huge success and an aha moment for them when they said, you know what, project management actually helped us make an informed decision 6 months earlier than we would have. We would have spent all this time doing all this work and realized we can't actually launch what we wanted to launch. And so for that organization, that sparked an interest in developing skills, and the skill development didn't happen through a lot of structured training. It actually happened on real projects in real time. So we'd sit down together and we'd say, okay, new initiative, let's start to plan that out. Let's start to look at what stakeholders, let's provide you a bit of coaching as we go. We were in the meetings with them. We were providing feedback to them afterwards. And what happened was that organization went from delivering a project, a new product to market in about 14 months to 8 months. They went from constantly fighting fires to individuals saying, we want to be part of this project. This is an exciting thing. And when we spoke to the sponsor about, you know, what value they felt the capability we delivered was, and that capability was a little bit around framework and skilling. They said, it's nothing about the framework and it's really not much about the skilling either. What it drove for us is our teams being able to work so much better together cross-functionally. You know, it opened up better lines of communications across different teams. And because of that, they were able to achieve in a lot faster rate. And they moved from sort of being number three in the market to being market leader within 24 months. So wow. It had a real tangible benefit to their organization. And it drove a lot of energy. So when I think of capability, when I think of what that does to an organization, I think of that client as an example. You know,
that's a fantastic example. And you mentioned their structure a few times. And I wonder if we might just go down this first rabbit hole on the podcast of structure. When you talk about structure, there's very many elements to structure, everything from processes to data. You mentioned communications. Yes. I wonder if you could peel back some of those layers around structure and what you actually mean. Are you talking about, you know, the classical project management type structure, your OBS, your WBS, et cetera, or is there more to it for those listening?
Yeah, absolutely more to it. I mean, when we look at capability and the structures that they sit within, one element is around project methods and standards. You know, what are some core elements that you need right at the outset to plan and deliver your project? What are some of the decision-making structures that we need? So we focused a fair bit on governance structures and assurance reviews. This is an organization that is marketing-based. They're not, you know, in the engineering space. Project management is it just a means to an end? It's not something that they're very passionate about. So how do we drive better decision-making that doesn't slow down projects? So we looked at methods, we looked at engagement structures, we looked at governance structures, and we really looked at collaboration in particular. You know, how do teams engage with different stakeholders? How do they work with them on a frequent basis? And how do they drive ownership and accountability? So when we first started, they were talking about this person is a project manager for this section, this person's a project manager for this section, and this person's a project manager for section three. But well, who's ultimately accountable? And the answer was no one. So we looked at structure across a few different lenses. And then when we looked at what sort of skills and what sort of attributes are needed to operate and support those things, The first thing that we started with was really with the executive, and we said, what skills do you need to develop to help you better make decisions on projects? And so we focused a lot on, you know, core insights that they need to be challenging their project managers on, so that there was skills development in that regard. And when we looked at the project leaders, it wasn't necessarily too much about developing a schedule or developing a plan, because their projects are relatively simple, but it was about how do you drive the vision for your project? How do you get your teams working well as a group? How do you deal with conflict or those sorts of issues within your working environment, within your team environment? How do you actually influence your project team? And so we built structures that would help individuals develop into core roles that were needed to successfully see the project launch. So,
did they know what they wanted when you asked these senior leaders?
They said, we want to operate with a lot less chaos. We want to be able to run projects where people feel that they want to be a part of that. And ultimately, they said, we want to be market leader.
Of course.
Yeah. So other than that, they didn't know how. They didn't know what they were missing. You know, you talk about project, you talk about program or portfolio management. Those terms were foreign to them as well. So, yeah.
No, it's interesting, because often I think we've all worked in various places where, well, except you, Michael, you've been at Blue Visions for 20 years, but you've worked with many organizations, right?
True. So
you work with many organizations, and you often ask leaders of businesses, you know, they often can tell you what's wrong and things aren't working. But then when you turn around and go, what do you actually really want? They struggle a little bit. And I think that's where a really clear, pardon the pun, vision, Blue Visions, comes into play, where you can provide that sort of, you know, consultancy and say, actually, this is what you need rather than what you want. So it's quite an interesting one. But just sticking with structure a little bit, you touched on a range of topics around structure that I feel comes down to the core of the individual. And I'd imagine in Australia, Melbourne, Sydney, wherever, there's a melting pot similar to London and places like New York, etc., around the world, where you've got multicultural organizations.
Yes.
And so then the challenge would be, is how do you structure culture, organizational culture, when you've got so many underlying cultures? Because if that is then at the heart of behaviors, how we communicate with each other, how transparent we are or not, all these various facets which lead you, because in some respects, the technical and the theory is easy. Right? That's the work breakdown structure. Follow it. That's an organizational breakdown structure. That's what you need to do. This is a communications plan, and this is the process. That's what you need to do. But there's little small nuances around it. Is there any special magic trick that you've come across?
Yeah. Look, for me, it's a really good question. And within Australia, you know, there's not really one organization that we've worked with that hasn't had a number of different individuals from different backgrounds within it. But it's a really good point. And so what we have focused on in particular is connecting it back to the organization's visions and the organization's values, because those values drive behaviors. So when we first start, a lot of the conversations, and we're doing this with an organization at the moment where we're building a project management framework for them, and then we're providing some skilling to support that. And one of the first questions we asked them was, tell us a bit about your vision, tell us a bit about your values and about the behaviors that you'd like to see exhibited. A lot of that drives the why. So the project management framework itself will have embedded within it the organization's values. So how do you move away from just, and we talk about this with a number of organizations, where you move away from compliance-based tasks. So the framework talks about, you've got to plan, you've got to do a schedule, you've got to do your risks, you've got to do your reporting on a weekly or fortnightly or monthly basis or whatever it is. But it doesn't necessarily, so it can drive a lot of compliance-based project management. So we try to shift the conversation back into why these things are important and how they're connected back into the organization's value. If I can, I'll share a story. This is not from my own direct experience, but one of our facilitators, Dominic, You know, we're called in to Taronga Zoo. So it's a huge zoo within Australia, and to do a project review. And so we had a number of individuals coming into the room, and the project manager was the last one in the room, walking in, shoulder slumped, sort of sat in the chair, a bit slouched. And the facilitator said, welcome everyone, tell me, what is this project all about? And the project manager, you know, speaking it quite softly, said, you know, we're just upgrading the car park, you know, not a big deal. And this facilitator said, great, tell me why. Well, by upgrading the car park, we're going to have greater capacity to allow more visitors into the zoo. Great, tell me, why is that important? Well, if more people are coming to the zoo, they're going to learn about animal conservation. They're going to learn about respecting, you know, nature. And great, how is that important? And ultimately, it feeds back into the vision of the zoo. And so what that individual was able to do was tie back into that particular project group, not just what they're doing, not just what their task is. And I think all of us would have been on a project where the kickoff is, you know, this is what we're doing. This is your job. This is your job. This is your job. This is your time. This is how much you've got to do. Go on and do it. And there's not much time that connects it back into the vision and the values. And so when we build these structures, I guess what for us has worked as a bit of a magic ingredient is to connect any structure, any solution, any project engagement to that organization's vision and that organization's values. And if we do that, you know, those people are working within that organization because hopefully that they're passionate about what that organization does. And so if you can connect it back into that passion, then you see the mood change. And certainly on that project, the project manager's mood changed, the voice changed, the team, the energy changed in that room when they started to realize actually it's not just a car park project. We're doing something a lot greater.
Yeah. No, that's powerful. That is really powerful. And just one more from me before I hand to Val. Is there a point at which diversity and inclusion sort of jars with visions and values? Because if you have individuals that don't hold those same visions and values of the company, do you go ahead and incorporate them in the name of diversity and inclusion? Or is it a case of having a difficult conversation and saying, we don't know if you're the right fit for this organization? Where does that line stand?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, for Institute of Management and a lot of the things that we do, those individuals are in the organization already. So we don't do too much in the, is this individual right or wrong? But what we do, and absolutely we see how diversity actually has a role on project teams. We see individuals from certain cultures that are used to speaking slightly louder, individuals that, from certain cultures that are used to being a little bit more passive and quiet and not speaking up. And so absolutely, I think what you've touched on there from a organizational context, it's key for the management group to set what does diversity mean, and not just the fact that we've got a multicultural organization, but what do we understand about that multiculture and how do we factor that into the overall sort of values of the organization, but also for a project leader, for someone that's driving a project team, to have a greater awareness of diversity, have a greater awareness of what that inclusion nature is, may mean that the project manager is not just asking an open forum any comments or questions and having one or two people that generally speak up and nine that don't. But then he's going out and having conversations with the nine that don't, because they're more comfortable speaking one-on-one. And so, Dale, to your point, this is for us not a technical skill of project management, but this is the leadership behaviors. These are the components that sit around people leading project teams and empowering individuals within their team. And you're spot on. An awareness of diversity is fundamental to that.
it's a really difficult space, I think, to make that decision. And, you know, if those listening want to hear a bit of a more in-depth conversation around it, go back to episode 53, where we spoke to Amel and IJ. And the key underlying message there was it's around diversity of thought, not necessarily skin color or sex or gender or whatever the case may be, but diversity of thought. So thanks, Michael. I'll hand to Val.
Yeah, no, just to add to that as well, you know, if we got to avoid group class and work more towards individuals. And I think that's exactly what Amal and IJ were saying, which is just really valuable. You know, you don't want to hire a whole bunch of people like you, which we do see in organizations, and you get a whole bunch of yes men or yes people, and you get this groupthink kind of dynamic, which doesn't help leadership at all. But we've had a few episodes where we've talked about these soft skills. You know, we talked about fusion skills and this kind of T branch of having technical and behavioral attributes. And I think capability is a really good, nice way to explain it. But I'm going to pivot a little bit, because I want to get your insight on a few things. one of them is HR as a body of knowledge, as a department, and how it's kind of changed and morphed over the last 10 years. And I know you can give me more insight than I probably can explain it. But one of the things that I think is really challenging, and maybe for some of the listeners out there, is there's training and then there's capability. So my first question before we go into the HR rabbit hole number two, Dale, is talking about what is the difference between training and capability? Because let's give the listeners a fair base definition for the two.
Absolutely. So, you know, training for us, when you look at an individual, is focused on driving improvements in knowledge and skills and to an extent behaviors, if you can achieve that for that individual. Capabilities, how that then transforms into the organization and what impact that actually has, the tangible impact that has to the organization. So you can drive increased skills for large teams and look at their knowledge and look at their behaviors. But does that actually translate into better results for the organization? And for us, the conversation always starts with what are the outcomes that you're trying to achieve? What are the components that are going to help you achieve those outcomes? And you find people absolutely is fundamental to that. The skills, knowledge, and behavior is absolutely key. But a really good individual within an organization that doesn't have maybe a similar level of maturity will get frustrated. And an organization that has a very high level of maturity, but the individual skills are not out there, will not also thrive. So for us, capability is looking across the people component, but also looking across organizational structures, organizational processes, and systems.
Yeah, brilliant. And no, that's a really good insight. And the other distinction is that it used to be, well, at least when I was going through, let's call it Project Academy, you know, when I was going through the project management, whatever you call it, training and the experiential learning, HR kind of, and I guess learning and development in a way, mandated and dominated the frameworks and the training paths and career paths for most project management or project professionals. But what we're seeing now, at least in Australia, I can't speak for the UK, is actual project teams are defining and deciding on what they need for their teams. And then they're actually going to market themselves. Are you finding that's a trend now? Is that something that's shifted over the last 10, 20 years in your experience?
Yeah, for us, we see organizations with really two approaches to L&D. One is where the L&D is simply a facilitator. So a team has a need, the L&D goes and sources a provider for that need. But the much more mature and evolving L&D group is when they actually hold the teams that are going out for training to account to drive an outcome. And what do I mean by that? At the moment, we're running some project management fundamental courses for a client up in Queensland. And from the outset, we said, well, what level of accountability are we going to see from those individuals, both beforehand, both in setting their goals and in applying those goals? And so individuals are having really a little bit more of a robust conversation with their manager around great, if I go on this training, what is it that I'm going to bring back and what am I going to change as a result of that training? And then what happens post that is actually holding those individuals to account and supporting them. So it's a two-way thing. And so mature organizations that are, that have a more mature L&D group are having L&D work with the teams to say, okay, the training piece is this bit in the middle. It's the, you know, the, if you're familiar with the 70-20-10, where 10% of learning happens in a classroom, you know, it's only the 10%. The 70% is actually in the workplace. It's actually applying it. It's practicing it. It's refining your craft. You know, I'm not sure if you'd trust a mechanic to fix your car who's never actually fixed a car, but has learned all the theories. And so part of it is, practice your craft and be provided the opportunity. And so we are seeing growing shifts in L&D areas that are moving away from a transactional based approach to training, where the most important thing for them is the price. And if you're getting 5 out of 5s in your evaluation scores, to much more of a, well, let's drive this capability. Let's look at a broader result that we want to achieve.
Yeah, no, that's really, really good. And I think that, you know, I liken it to, you know, going back to technology, but I liken it to the IT department in businesses where, you know, back in the day, they used to mandate as well, the architecture and the systems and software that, you know, they gathered the requirements from the business and they said, well, this is what you shall use. But you're also seeing that change as well, where business seems to have, or business units, particularly project management and PMO and senior execs have more influence over IT learning and development and all the other facets, which is really, really exciting. And in particular in Australia, we're seeing a lot more around project controls and integrated systems, which is great. I'm going to talk about something that you talked about offline before we press recorded, something around integrated learning. Now that might be a foreign term to a lot of people listening to this. And I thought maybe we could just unpack that for a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what we've seen a lot of organizations do, and still to this day do, is they say, you know, we're having issues with our projects, and so let's put people on project management training. And then they'll say, oh, you know, we're not managing change particularly well. Let's put them on change management training. And, you know, we need to help them sort of work with their teams. Let's put them on some leadership training. And you've got an individual who may have had 15 days or 10 days of discrete training that is not connected, not integrated. And so part of what we're seeing organizations do is take a much more integrated view of the core skills that are needed and not treat them as siloed structures. So if you want to build project capability, why not look at some of the technical skills that an individual needs, but let's look at how they also establish a project vision, how they empower a project team. Let's look at how they manage change. And let's look at a number of these different elements coming together in a connected environment. So we're seeing some real shifts away from sort of an individual going and studying a discipline and then going and studying an add-on to that and an add-on to that, to individuals saying, an organization saying, we want to take a bit of this component out of leadership. We want to take a bit of this component out of change and this component out of project management. And we want to deliver it as a bespoke or tailored solution for our clients. And the other element around integrated is organizations are starting to place a better emphasis on learning in the flow of work. And learning in the flow of work is an interesting concept in itself, because it introduces concepts like micro learning. You know, you're having an issue with something. How can you access some insight about that and get that almost on demand? And so micro learning and micro credentialing is also being added as another piece of the puzzle. I know with COVID having just still very active, but a lot of individuals last year in particular working virtually, you know, a lot of the workshops that we're running for clients was around, how do you lead virtual project teams? How do you drive project performance when individuals are not in a room whiteboarding on a screen, but they're they're at home. You know, how do you maintain performance in that context? So that integrated elements of project management plus virtual team environments plus you know, other aspects, change management, resilience, dealing with change into a solution. And so when we talk about integrated solution, we're talking about pulling together multiple components and having strategies to really embed that into that organization.
Yeah, no, brilliant. And one more for me, because if I don't ask this, I'm going to forget. And I don't want to, because I love digital. And we talk about it a lot offline, Michael, because we talk about this stuff. We love it. You know, digital being so rapid and so forthcoming in project management in particular. If you went to the Project Controls Expo, which, by the way, is in November, you would see by just the volume and the number of software companies, SaaS companies that are there, that are sponsoring, that have stalls, there's hundreds and hundreds of them. And I know Dale and I talk about, you know, analysis and paralysis about, well, which option do you have? Because, you know, back to the original conversation we started with, a lot of the time the client knows kind of where they want to go. They've got some type of vision, but they don't know how to get there. They don't know what's available. And then you're bombarded with, you know, amazing words like artificial intelligence and machine learning. And what does that mean? But we're missing the element, and we've had a few episodes about this, haven't we, Dale? We keep coming back to people. And it's like, hang on, we're forgetting that even in a world where we have a smart city, you're still going to need smart resources who are capable to infer and understand what the machines are doing and present that information in a way that we can have empathetic and informed decision-making conversations, because projects are still run by people. As far as I know, that's not going to change in the next 100 years. Maybe it will. I don't know. but another podcast, perhaps, Dale.
maybe.
Yeah. So, you know, from your perspective, Michael, how do we stopgap, or at least, you know, talking about micro credentials, kind of go with the flow and keep people up to date? Because digital literacy is a problem in Australia. I imagine it's across the world. How do we keep up and keep up to date? What's your view on that?
Yeah, that's a really good and relevant point that's happening at the moment. We work with a lot of organizations that are going through huge digital transformations. And what we tend to see is a lot of the focus starts at the technology elements and focuses on the systems and AI and automation and things of that nature. And when you talk about what does that do in terms of your organizational culture, what does that do in terms of your workforce planning and your workforce strategies, what does that do in terms of the skills, the different skills that individuals are going to need, and how do you bring them along for that so that it's not, we've now changed, let's start to focus on building your skills, and in the meantime you've got some major issues and gaps. A lot of organizations that go through that are fundamentally going through transformational change, and transformational change is not a short-term thing, and ironically for us, it's an ongoing thing. You know, if you talk about how many organizations are going through transformational change, you'll say most of them, most of the time.
Exactly.
Because they're always shifting and pivoting and changing. So what we tend to do outside of the systems related element is help organizations identify what sort of culture are they looking to have in the future as their organization pivots and shifts. What sort of workforce do they need? What sort of skills are going to be needed to support that workforce? And then how do you build that digital literacy into there? And so individuals that may not spend too much time on a computer are going to, like you have to, like you said, understand what the computer is saying and deal with that, as opposed to, you know, so that skill is still a gap. That skill is interesting in the dynamics of the fact that we've got an aging workforce. We've got individuals that have done things one way and it's worked. And why should they do things any different? You know, so it's in part addressing hearts and minds, in part addressing a blueprint, a future blueprint that's not just a technology-based blueprint, but a culture, values, workforce, strategy, blueprint. And those organizations that are doing that well actually see a lot of momentum and energy through the transformations that they're making. And those organizations that don't do that as well tend to see a lot of additional pain that doesn't have to be suffered as they go through that change.
Yeah, no, that's really good. And I think you kind of mentioned it before, that digital literacy is probably related back to integrated learning, that, you know, it can never really stop. I mean, we're in this kind of continuous tumblefall of new innovations and new things coming out. And there is an apprehension maybe of the older generations, but I think the newer generations are so innate. I'll tell you a funny story, Michael, you probably don't know this. So other than high school where I did a little bit of programming, I didn't touch a computer until I was 24. Largely because I wasn't in a role where I required it. And so it blows people away, because that's all I do now is I'm literally on a computer 24/7. And, I remember that project management started off with some real basic tools. And I had this chief planner or master planner, they used to call them, who talked to me about having walls where they used string and they used this node method. And maybe you remember this, I don't know. But he said it was so much better because the physical effort of moving something made it almost like rote learning. It stuck in your mind. Whereas a lot of the time, people accessing tools and techniques now, the machine does it for you and you're not really appreciating the methods in which it's applying it. It's a bit like our iPhones. We appreciate them, but we don't know what the hell they're doing in the background other than surveying us.
That's right. Sending data.
Sending data, yeah. We are products. But I did want to comment, and I've got other questions, but I'm going to hand off to Dale because I know he's been listening and he's got a few more for you.
No, I can continue listening. It's been fascinating. let's I guess jump into the second part, and we've danced around a little bit about why education, learning and applying matter. I think applying is probably the key word there. And you mentioned 70-20-10, Michael.
Yes.
And let's just, for the listeners that haven't heard of that, just give a bit more of a basis of what that actually means and where it's come from.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks, Dale. Well, fundamentally, 70-20-10 has been quite well adopted across Australia, and it recognizes the fact that only 10% of learning actually happens in a formal setting, whether that be through a formal classroom or relearning or in a virtual training room. 20% of the learning happens through some unstructured learning, whether that be through coaching or support or reading or attending events like this. And 70% actually happens in real time in a workplace environment. And so what that organization often, and historically, but it's getting better now, has failed to recognize is how do you create a environment that's conducive to workplace-based learning? How do you create an environment where it's okay to experiment, to maybe fail in certain regards, but treat that as a learning exercise and continually improve from there? And historically, what we've seen is organizations send individuals on a classroom course in 3-4 days or what have you, and then they come back into the workplace and they don't do anything any different to what they were doing before. The pressures and the deadlines of the project are still with them. And it only takes a couple of weeks before you start to see a drop in retention of the learning. And then a few months after that, and the habits haven't been formed at all. So a lot of this capability piece for us is how do you actually create learning organizations that are willing to allow environments, provide environments to learn and to breed improvements through experimentational failure. And digital literacy is a fundamental part of that. You know, how do you experiment a little bit with that, see what's going to work, pivot, make some adjustments and go from there. And so fundamentally, that's where 70-20-10 comes into play. And that's where we find the more advanced L&D areas are very familiar with that. And their core role moves away from organizing a course to creating a learning culture within that organization.
No, thanks for laying that foundation. And I guess from a certain aspect, it's a no-brainer, right? You mentioned mechanics. Mm. You can throw doctors, pilots into that as well, right?
Yeah.
Although I do believe today you can get planes that don't need pilots. And we discussed it on a previous podcast. Val's very happy. He would jump into the plane without a pilot. I don't know if the masses would.
I would be nervous.
Exactly.
As long as I had a parachute, I'm fine. Yeah.
Yeah, but we've also previously spoken to the likes of Paul Googe that mentioned, you know, experience, and I think that's the 70, you know, percent part of it. Yes. Can be broken down, and you know, is it 20 years of experience that's built 1 year on top of the other, or is it 1 year repeated 20 times? So there's a value in the length of experience as well. So it's not just about quantity, but it's about quality as well. And so also if I try and turn this on its head, the 70-20-10, we're saying that 70% of learning happens in real time while we're living, breathing projects, our day-to-day. But what is the most important aspect of that? Is it then perhaps the foundation of that 10% to allow us to then learn that 70? Or actually it doesn't matter that much about that 10% classroom?
Yeah, it's a good question, and so we talk to an extent around informed learners and uninformed learners, and so an informed learner will have had an experience on a project site where they go, this really did not work. I really did not know what to do in this scenario, and I need to actually go out and learn about some of the techniques and tools and to really help improve what I've done for future projects. And so that's generally an informed learner where they know that they've had an issue and they need to do something about it. And that for us is the ideal learner because they've actually got an appetite to be there. They actually want, they've seen the result of what their current, you know, knowledge and skills has been. And they want to make an improvement to that. The other element is where an individual may be transitioning into a new role. You know, they may be moving in as part of a project team for the first time, or they may be running a slightly more complex or difficult project. And so they haven't yet had the experience that's connected with that particular initiative. And so they're going to learn for the first time tools and techniques and things like that. But it's a little bit harder for them to contextualize that learning. So whilst we try to use things like case studies and examples and relevant tools and templates and things of that nature, it's not till they actually get back in to their project environment. And it might not be immediately that they might not need to take what they've learned and apply it straight away because they haven't had that scenario where it's going to be applicable. And this is where the role of workplace learning comes into play, and in particular, managers of these individuals. You know, how do you continually bring them back to some of the new things they've learned and have them help them to apply it for the first time? So there's that contextual learning. Just in terms of your comment earlier around, do you learn something once over a year and apply it over and over 20 years on? You know, that's also a really good question. And I think, you know, this whole concept of continuous improvement around standards changing, systems changing, organizations changing, the type of initiatives that we're running changing, lends itself more to what you've almost learned in year one is a stepping stone to what you need to learn for year two, which is going to be a stepping stone for what you need to learn for year three. So it's you've never reached a point where you've learned it all. And it's that, I think, appetite for continually learning and continually trying different things, which is a cultural thing. You know, that may be quite strong within a person, but how do you drive it across an organization? And that's a cultural aspect. That is core to those organizations that we consider peak performing or high performing. Is they're not just saying, we did this last year, it worked in this way, let's just do it again. They're saying, it worked, great. Can we refine it a little bit? Has the environment changed? Has the context changed where we need to pivot a bit?
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually, because it's quite strange where you do have people that want to continuously evolve and learn, yet when organizations do change, the same people throw their hands up and go, oh, why are we changing things again? So you can never win. But you mentioned earlier as well about on-project learning, so learning while the project is going on rather than separating the two. And then you also touched on micro-learning. So we've covered a lot about, you know, why it's important and perhaps, you know, the techniques around it. But for the individual, where do I access this micro-learning? Are there any hints and tips? Do I just get in touch on LinkedIn with Michael Cicciati and he tells me where they are? Or is there something absolutely. That you can share with those listening?
Yeah, absolutely. I find, I mean, micro-learning can happen in these sorts of forums. I think what's important is that there are some trusted forums that you become a little bit more familiar with if you're going to go through some micro-learning, because you can learn how to change a tire. That could be the completely wrong way on YouTube. And sometimes you may get lucky and sometimes you may not. and so I find industry groups, you know, the project control group, just to do a plug for that, or Australian Institute of Project Management, or, you know, individuals that you're following within the network. Often will be an amazing source of micro-learning tips. There are general and some generic sort of forums like Udemy and many like that, where they've got tens of thousands of short clips. But I tend to focus on those industry associations, those industry groups, and those trusted people as a source for some of the micro-learning content that we sort of take a little bit more seriously.
No, that is good tips. And yeah, there are plenty of institutions out there. Get involved, form your own network. We spoke previously to Jonathan Norman, you know, around creating communities of practice.
That's right.
And you know, and we're saying, you know, it doesn't, you don't have to go and look for one. You can form your own and you can just create that conversation. That's a form of micro learning, I guess, is what you're saying as well.
Exactly.
If I just pick on the phrasing of capability partnering and put a slightly different twist to it, and in a lot of organizations, if not all of them, you have consultancies involved on projects.
Yep.
How much responsibility or accountability is it on consultancies to improve the capability of their clients? Yeah. Is that part of the deal, or is it actually, you know what, if we never ever improve the capability of our clients, we'll always have work?
that's a really good question. Look, I'm seeing more and more now large government contracts where, as part of that contract, you've got a responsibility to transfer capability. But what we're not seeing is structures and strategies put in place to actually transfer that capability. So there's this perception that if I shadow Dale for 6 months, I'm going to be able to do what Dale does. And that's not necessarily the case, unless there's some structure in place or some strategies where there's, you know, coaching sessions, there's some, you know, short micro-learning clips, there's me practicing while you're observing, providing some feedback. The capability is never actually fully transferred into that organization. And that's just from a skill perspective. When you start to look at the organizational processes and tools that are going to help them in their future state, in their blueprint, it's also not covered. And so whilst we're seeing a lot of organizations talking about, well, part of your role as a consultancy is the transfer capability, we're seeing it's been given a little bit of lip service as opposed to having genuine structures and strategies like you would if you were rolling out a project and you've got a project plan and you're, all the controls that sit around it. I'm not sure how many you would have seen where there was capability strategies or capability transfer plans and strategies and reporting and things of that nature. It doesn't tend to get the same level of attention as the deliverables that that consultant is working on. And so whilst we're seeing it become more and more part of, in particular, large government bids and tenders, we're not necessarily seeing that being carried forward from either side, from the consultant side or from the client side. And so there's some really big opportunities to improve in that regard.
It's an interesting observation that, you know, it's there, the framework's there for it, yet it's not being harnessed. And I guess if we were playing that out in its true sense, and consultants were empowering their clients' resources with improving capabilities, etc., then what you'd almost have to have is a consultancy in its true aspect, where they are the expert, but they're continuously evolving ahead of their client. That's and that brings the whole industry forward together collectively. And that's what we really want. But then that brings me back to thinking, well, a lot of consultancies these days are body shops, bums on seats. And so how can you then be called a consultancy if you actually don't have the expertise to transfer the knowledge? And with the slow pipeline of new, fresh talent coming into the project management space, I struggle to see how we are actually improving capability. Is there quite a struggle from your perspective, just in general, to improve capability? I mean, if we don't have the people to improve, and those that we do have a low capability, how do we, other than listening to the Project Chatter podcast, of course, how do we spread the news? How do we just, you know, sort of make this big shift? And maybe there's no silver bullet, maybe there's no light switch, but I'm interested to hear your views and thoughts on this, about, you know, how we sort of mass improve capability across our profession.
Yeah, it's a really good question. Val, you didn't tell me I was going to get all the hard questions from Dale. So that's
well, you know, we play good cop, bad cop, and sometimes Dale can't help himself. But you're doing well. You're doing well. I'm scoring you. You're good. You're good.
Very nice. Look, I think you know, you almost got to take one bite at a time within a large industry, and that bite for us starts really at quite a senior level within an organization, and their appetite to actually, you know, how are they being measured themselves? So if I look at a number of executives and that are driving really large initiatives or even smaller initiatives, a large part of their mandate is deliver that initiative. And if you don't deliver that initiative, there's going to be consequences. And if you do deliver that initiative, you're going to be rewarded. But their focus remains relatively short-term. And those initiatives may be 2 or 3 years long, but their focus remains on that initiative. So really the conversation starts with some really senior players within the client side, and ideally prior to any procurement, where we talk about you want to bring a partner in to deliver certain things with you, but you want them to impart capability. What is it that you want to see imparted? What is it that you'd like to see this organization transform into? What does that blueprint look like? And really set the architecture up for that within the client side. Then when there's an approach to market, it's actually not just motherhood statements. It's not just, we want you to deliver this package of work and in the process also transfer capability. But they actually talk about the tangibles, the capability they'd like to see transferred. Is that we want to have, you know, 50 experts in this by the time this initiative is finished. We want to have some very simple processes or robust structures in place for X, Y, and Z. We want to see our teams operating in this sort of manner moving forward. And so a large part of the homework actually happens before the consultancy is engaged. And then as part of the formation of that project team, that joint project team between the consultancy and the organization, it's establishing the core visions for that initiative. And those visions and those values need to link back not only to deliverables, but need to link back into an organizational blueprint. You know, what does that organization look like capability-wise moving forward? And so if organizations are doing that one organization at a time, you start to see a shift in behavior across an industry. It still remains academic in part, this capability transfer, because it's quite motherhood statement orientated. But it really has to come down to putting smart goals in place, putting the real tangibles, doing the thinking around that blueprint. That will then be part of a deliverable. So if you deliver the scope of the project, well done, you get, you know, 5 points. If you deliver the capability piece, you get another 5 points. That's your 10 points out of 10. So
perfect.
No, that Dale, is awesome. An easy question now.
Yeah. Well, I was going to defend you there. I think as well, back to Dale's point, you know, it's also about being a responsible client and not hiring these body shops. You know, back to Michael's point, is actually articulate what you want. And maybe you do need, and I know Michael does this, and we certainly do that, is maybe there's a little a gap assessment of the organization, the culture and the vision first before you go and dive into a full deployment. Again, you know, very similar to technology, these big bang approaches don't work. And if you're aware that you're with a consultancy that is just filling bodies and putting bums on seats, why are you signing the orders? You know, notice how that's all the clients is. A peeve of mine. I would love more responsible clients to put me on the hook, and Michael for that matter, and say, you're part of this KPI. We're going to hold you to this, whatever that might be. And it is, as you said, it is a partnership in the real sense of the word. I think that's what consultancy was originally. It's just kind of morphed. Yes. Part and parcel, like, you know, both teams could be blamed, but, you know, it's kind of morphed into this kind of, well, we'll do whatever we need to do to get work. And then the client will be like, well, we'll do whatever we need to get the people we want, the individuals, regardless of who they work for. And it's like, well, none of this is really going to be a positive outcome if the idea is that you're not really aligned to the vision of the company and you're not really understanding what the tactical deliverables are and how you transfer that capability at the end of the engagement. We get asked a lot. And engagement is a hard thing from capability perspective because you've got the skills and competencies that you want to transfer, but there's also this knowledge as well. You know, the fact is that consultancies work on intellectual assets. That's how they make money. They're knowledge workers. And you only want them for a brief period of time because these knowledge workers are painfully expensive. And that's where I think capability partnering is probably the long-term strategic and cost-effective choice. If I was on the client side, Dale, like, from your perspective, I mean, how do you see it? You can train someone over time and they have a really nice journey in project management and they learn through, you know, on the job, but also some formal settings. Or the opposite, you bring in a whole bunch of guys that can do the job, but as soon as they leave these big gaping holes, which we've both experienced. So it's a really interesting perspective. And we've talked about a lot of things. It's great, Michael. You've held your own. So well done. Dale knows his stuff and he's got some really interesting questions. And he knows because he's experienced some of this. So he's asking from his own experiences, which is great.
But also, Val, I wouldn't ask tough questions if I didn't think Michael had the answers, right? You clearly are experienced. You've worked across a lot of organizations and you've seen a lot. And this is part of learning for people listening into this. And so those leaders that are listening to this of those organizations, as Val said, and you said, Michael, know what you want from your consultancy. Work together with them to improve. I guess back to your point, Val, just quickly, on whether you have, you know, these experts come in, deliver your project and go versus empowering and improving your own resources. I think it's a mixture. Don't get me wrong. The questions I'm asking are meant to be provocative to try and get some of these little gems out or nuggets, as we like to call them. But I think there's two parts to it. There is one, yes, you are the expert or you should be the expert. And as you say, you should be the knowledge worker that understands more than what we know. And there's two parts to that. Help us deliver better, faster, quicker, safer, but also help us improve our capability. So I think it's dual. I don't think it's one or the other.
Yeah. I might just add to that quickly. A lot of the experts themselves, though, are also experts at their craft. So that they're very good at the technical component that they've been brought into. And they themselves may not be good at transferring capability. You know, they're an amazing doer. But, you know, in terms of now you are tasked with transferring that capability, how do you actually do that? And so there is a skill to transfer capability. There is a skill to build capability. And I think that is an element that has to be considered. You know, does the organization or does the consultancy have the skills it needs to put in place those capability pathways, the capability strategies? And if it doesn't, then, you know, there's an opportunity there to actually call that out and get some support in that regard.
That's such a good point, Michael. You're right. You know, you could be a fantastic 15-year planner with this ability to shape shift schedules into optimized programs. then you go, right, now can you hand that over to Dale? And you go, oh, I've given him everything. I've made it for it. But, you know, Dale's might have a learning disability or not being able to pick up this information, and he might need it in a certain format and a structure.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's a really good point. I'm going to ask one more question because I don't think we've talked about it yet, but it's probably prevalent given COVID and isolation and just mental health in general. How do we prevent, so with all this education and having these boxed in lives because COVID's wreaking havoc still globally and affecting the way we work with each other, how do we manage education on top of work, on top of family? You know, I've got kids, I've got a dog snoring next to me. How do I manage this education, continuous learning while still balancing everything out? Because there'll be a lot of people listening, I imagine, who really do want to learn. You know, maybe it's not necessarily in their field, but they know 3 steps away or year 3 from where they are now, that's going to be important. How do they, do you have any tips for those people? You might not know. Do you have any tips for those people listening?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've almost answered your own question there, Val. you talk about knowing where it is that you want to be getting, where it is that you're heading, and articulating some of the skills that need to be developed to support you get there. I think the days of having quite intense workshops, you know, that go over a week and then it's sort of set and forget and all the best with it is behind us to an extent now. I think we're seeing large shifts to bite-sized learning. And the bite-sized learning may still be the 10%, so that may still be structured formal learning, but it may occur in half day or one day every 6 weeks or 2 months. Sort of increments as opposed to sort of over a very intense period. And I think there's a lot of content that's now out there, whether it be through, because people learn differently. You know, those that learn through reading or relearning or short clips or listening to podcasts or actually needing an instructor to be there to facilitate conversation and ask questions. There's different learning styles out there. So one is really have a clear picture of where you're heading and what sort of skills you want to develop. Two, have an honest reflection of how best you learn, you know, or what are the ways in which you learn best. And then three, there's no shortage of content and there's no shortage of providers that can help provide that knowledge, but have a strategy to actually apply that on a regular basis immediately. I think if your strategy is, I'm going to take this learning because I really want to apply it now, you will get benefit from the learning. And you will spend time while your dog's snoring to actually do the learning. But if you don't have that strategy, if you've been asked to do the training, you're not seeing why it's connected to what you want to do down the line, and you don't really have an intent to make any changes, then it's probably just a waste of your time actually doing that learning. So that would be the 3 tips. Know where you're going, know how you learn, and have a strategy for actually how you're going to apply and embed that learning yourself.
Well, there you have it, listeners. Wise words from Mr. Michael Chatty. Dale, over to you.
Thanks, Val. Yeah, I was just listening in there. I think we almost need like an independent body, global body that has this menu of like where you go to learn various things for what you want. Someone listening out there will be keen to start something like that. Maybe it started already, we just haven't heard about it. If you're around, get in touch, we'll talk to you.
Get in touch.
Exactly. Michael, it's been great, this podcast. As we head towards the end, we have a feature called Defend the Indefensible. It's inspired by ridiculous statements we've heard. And we've heard quite a lot of ridiculous statements by myself and Val on this podcast throughout the episodes. but it's inspired by some of those. And what we do is we put this ridiculous statement to our guest, you today, and you have to defend it for 30 seconds. So a bit of fun. Okay. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's defend.
Okay. You have 30 seconds and it starts after I read out the statement, which is, it's easier and better for project delivery to employ people who think the same.
Yeah, absolutely. You employ people that think the same, you're not going to have any arguments. Complete cohesion. Teamwork is going to be absolutely number one. You're going to achieve, obviously, a much better result because you're not going to have divergent thoughts. So just heading down the one path, one vision, and you're going to get there a lot faster. So definitely, I think, employ people with the same exact thought as you do have.
Good timing. Well done.
I don't know if that was 30 seconds, but I got to wash my mouth almost now. It feels like I got to...
A bit of fun there, Michael, at the end. And yeah, thanks for being a great sport. So as we head to the end of the podcast, do you have any final thoughts you want to leave the listeners with?
Look, I think the final thought is if you're within an organization and you have a passion for learning, really try and influence those to drive things like learning cultures. If you generate learning cultures, if you're willing to take a chance, you're going to see a much better result down the line. So I think learning cultures are what we want to see within organizations. And if you've got a learning culture, you're going to drive that capability.
Very, very well put. Val, final thoughts from you?
I know. I think Michael did very well to fare all those difficult questions, but also, you know, we didn't talk about it, but, you know, we're going to have to compete more on how you retain staff in the future. And one of those things that especially the younger generation are looking for is opportunities to learn and grow and flourish in a positive culture. They're just not going to put up with the same old school style. So, you know, learning and development is really going to be important in the future. And yeah, thanks, Michael, for sharing your views.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Val and Dal, for having me on.
It has been fantastic. Just before we go, we have one more surprise for you, Michael. We have a pop quiz called Tenor. And okay. For this, we'll bring in our in-house navigator, Sabine. Sabine, gosh. Hey, so Sabine, you've come on screen there. You've unmuted yourself. If you wouldn't mind, Sabine, taking Michael through Tenor.
Of course, I would love to. Hi, Michael. So you've answered all the easy questions, so we get on with the tricky ones. So what's your morning routine?
Morning routine. Well, I've got a seven-year-old. I've got three kids, but my seven-year-old comes and knocks on my door every morning, 6 o'clock, before the sun's up, and says, let's go play some tennis. And so he's getting me out of bed onto the tennis courts, which I actually thank him for, before I actually start my day. So that's my new morning routine, thanks to my seven-year-old.
Nice.
That sounds great. So you have your exercise in the morning already. So that's brilliant.
Absolutely.
So would you rather spend your day with people or with technology?
For me, people. I love being around individuals with a glass of wine or a scotch and a bit of cheese and just barbecues, picnics, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, definitely in front of people.
Oh, that sounds nice. So, the next one is a good one. How do you deal with stress?
Very good question. In actual fact, I think to an extent, sport helps me deal with stress. Actually getting out there and hacking a few balls on the golf course or playing a bit of tennis with the little ones, where you can actually completely take your mind off any sort of stress, is really helpful for me.
Okay. So what is the best book you have been gifted?
Books. So the one that actually inspires me a fair bit is a book by Dominic Sear called What's Great About This? If you have a look at that, highly recommend it. It's a book, no matter what the scenario is, no matter what the situation, it's the lens of what is great about this. And that just shifts the mind away from a negative to something very positive. So that's the best book I've been gifted.
I guess that's really helpful as well, in particular in your profession.
Absolutely. We have to find the positives in everything.
Yes. Okay. So if you could choose to spend a day with anyone, past or present, who would it be and why?
Really good question. I think for me, probably Tiger Woods or Roger Federer. It's not just how good they've become in their craft, but mentally how resilient they are and how well they are with people, how humble they are as well. And I think just to learn what goes into making a champion and keeping them humble and keeping them resilient. I'd love to spend a day with either of those, Federer or Woods.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very nice. So you're practicing there anyway, don't you?
Absolutely.
Hang on, where are we? What's the best piece of advice you've been given?
Look on the bright side of life. Ultimately for me, this has been the best bit of advice. Gratitude is the other, like just that word, you know, the more you show gratitude for what you've got, the less concerned you are about the things you don't have. Those two things for me.
Yeah, that sounds nice. I do the same actually, so I completely understand. So what is the biggest mistake you have made on a project?
Oh, on a project, okay. There's a long list of those. What's the what's the biggest? I think for me, it was about how I worked with a particular sponsor on a project. So my personality is quite different. I'm quite collaborative, and I'll tell a bit of a story. And she hated that, and she just said, "Get to the bloody point, stop talking." and so for the first few months, and I was lucky, my mentor sort of pulled me up on it. I'd sort of give executive updates, and it'd be, you could see it almost snapping. After that, it was sort of straight to the point. Here's where we're at. In the first sort of 10 seconds, it was an update on the project. And then she said, "Great, okay, can we finish this meeting now?" So it wasn't really a huge sort of catastrophe on a project, but it was really about a big shift in how I learned about dealing with different people on projects.
Yeah, I guess you find loads of different characters, I guess. Yeah.
For sure.
So what advice would you give your 10-year-old self?
I think really just go for, be brave and follow your dreams. I think you encounter a lot of individuals that will tell you why something is not going to work, or why something shouldn't happen, or why you should do something differently. I think there's a courage in following and staying true to yourself and staying true to your own dreams. So that would be the advice.
So did you follow your dreams?
I have. I deviated a bit, and I've learned the painful way of what happens when you do deviate. You start to lose a bit of passion and a bit of interest in it. And it's when you get back on it and you start going, you know what, this is what I really love doing, that you sort of refine that spark. So yeah, I partly followed it. and now back on it again.
So next question will be then right in the right ballpark. So what profession other than your own would you like to have attempted?
Oh, really good question. My wife, and she's going to listen to this, even though she's not at all in project management, makes personalized chocolates. And I would love to be a chocolatier. It's just amazing watching her making all these really nice chocolates and sampling them in excess. So she's very fortunate.
If I would do them, then nothing would be left, to be honest. So if you had to spend 1 million in a day, what would you spend it on?
1 million in a day. It wouldn't be buying a house in Sydney, that's for sure. I reckon I'd have... I don't know, like, what would I do? I'd buy a really nice boat. I'd have about 150 people on a massive party, all drinks served, on a cruising on a really nice boat. I think I'd be able to spend $1 million in a day, and I'd have a nice car waiting for me in the garage.
Am I invited to your party?
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. Just need to get that $1 million and I'll be there.
Oh my gosh. We have to play the lottery, I think. That sounds good. Well, thank you very much for having a bit of fun. And today now.
Thanks, Sabine. Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking Michael through. That's been interesting, just getting a view into your personality and what goes on there. Michael, I'm jealous because, you know, you talk about, you know, having a barbecue and maybe a scotch, and you and Val are there in Australia and you can do that. So hopefully if the borders open, I'll pop over. We'll have that scotch together one day.
Very welcome.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure. Maybe Sabine will join me when we'll come across. But folks, that is all the time we have on this episode. It doesn't have to stop here. You can support our charities, access our blogs, or if you think you have something interesting, I can't even talk anymore, something interesting to share, visit projecttatterpodcast.com. Remember, you can also leave us a voice message if you visit our anchor page. So please do that, and you may appear on one of our episodes with your voice in audio form. Don't forget to subscribe on our YouTube channel and your podcast player so you don't miss the next one. A massive, massive thank you to Michael Cicchetti, and thank you all for listening. Till next time, we say stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. From me, Val, and Sabine, it's bye for now. Views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.